Good morning and welcome to Successful Investing with me, Jack Monteith.
And me, Ken Smith.
This is a show that's designed to help you build wealth, protect wealth, and enjoy the fruits of your success. Ken and I have a combined 35 years experience in the financial world. We're both owners in two wealth management firms, Empirical Wealth Management and Directional Financial Services. We're both certified financial planners. I'm a CPA, and Ken has a master's degree in financial analysis. The point is, we're going to help you navigate through all of the noise and endless investment choices to become successful investors. We encourage you to send us your questions or ideas for discussion topics at our website. You can visit our website at www.successfulinvestingradio.com or email us at contact@successfulinvestingradio.com. We've got this show will feature guest speakers on investment topics. Today's guest will be Ethan Broga, who is a certified financial planner with a master's degree in financial planning. His topic today, we're going to talk about what's new in the IRA and Roth area. What are the limitations? Who should contribute to IRAs or Roths? And various topics as it relates to that.
Pretty timely, considering the tax deadline coming up here, Jack. And Jack, start our show. I'd like to ask you a question. Every show we're having a question, and one of the questions I have for you is, in your opinion, what do you think one of the largest mistakes that investors make?
Well, I guess what's the biggest mistake? There's probably about 300 big mistakes, but one of the most common mistakes is, people get into investments or buy their investments without thoroughly understanding, what the heck they're getting into. They don't understand how that investment might perform, in the bad times, such as times like this. They don't understand the characteristics of that investment. How will it perform in the good times? Really, what's it designed to do? What kind of returns it designed to do? What kind of volatility it's designed to do? They don't understand, how that investment fits in with other investments they might have.
It's kind of like buying a set of tires before you've picked out what type of car you want, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, people buy their investments based on, what's the latest top 10 mutual funds in the investment magazines, and they project out today's performance into what they think it's going to do into the future. And Ken, you and I both know that today's hottest mutual funds are probably next year or the year after going to be somewhere in the bottom to middle as far as performance.
That's right. I mean, we've seen studies on looking at the highest rated mutual funds. A lot of people use a company called Morningstar. They're great in terms of providing information about mutual funds. However, I think the mistake that most investors make is they skip that information and go right to the star rating system.
Right.
And there's been a lot of studies that show that ranking system, if you were to look at it and you picked the top 10 or the highest rated funds that historically had a 4 or 5 star rating, and then you said, well, let's look what happened over the subsequent 3 to 5 to 10 years. And what you found is that the funds that had the high ratings when you purchased them, in many, many cases, wound up being at the bottom of the list in the subsequent period of time.
Right. How true.
So we get that question from our clients quite a bit when we don't, we are not using Morningstar to, at least their rating system, to filter or to pick our funds. And so we get questions from time to time as to why do we own an investment that doesn't have the highest Morningstar rating. And it's in our opinion, you don't want to use rating systems alone. It's also interesting when you look at Morningstar and then you look at other rating systems out there, you can get two completely different ratings based on which system you're looking at or what subscription you're getting.
Well, and it goes back to the fact that I believe most or a lot of investors, they really don't know and understand what they're investing into. And, You know, they don't understand the cost associated with it. You know, and unfortunately in our industry, there's quite a few advisors or salespeople that don't even understand the investments that they're selling and placing for clients. So, you know, getting to know what you're investing in. And, you know, I guess that, what is that old saying, keep it simple, stupid?
Yeah.
I mean, really, investing, you can make it as complicated as you want, but it doesn't mean that it's better, and it doesn't mean that, you know, overall it's going to, long-term it's going to provide for, you know, providing and achieving your goals. So, you know, keep it simple. And you and I, Ken, I mean, that we're big believers in a passive approach. And
right.
You know.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, I think the industry has done a fantastic job perpetuating the idea that in order to be successful at investing, the strategies have to be very complicated or esoteric, and only the super high net worth individuals can really make a lot of money because the whole thing is tilted in their favor. And that's not true at all, in our opinion. It can be a very simple strategy that's broadly diversified, that matches your investment time horizon, your investment goals. There are very simple techniques that we're going to talk about continuously throughout on our show that you can take to build a portfolio that doesn't require a whole lot of work. And you can hire someone like us to manage your portfolio for you as well.
You know, it's just, you know, in America, you know, anybody can become financially successful and financially independent. I mean, there's two main ways. You can own your own business and build that business up and become wealthy, or you can own a basket of all kinds of different businesses, and you do that by participating in the stock market. Anybody in the United States can do that, but you know, it's complicated, and you know, we don't get taught how to do that in schools. And you know, we learn the math and the reading and all of that, but we really don't learn how to become successful investors. And then when it's time to start saving, we're bombarded by, you know, all kinds of hype and noise. And,
yeah.
You know, so how the heck does the investor know, you know, where even to get started?
Well, I think that's where we can be of help in helping them to differentiate between what is an advertisement or a sales pitch and what is actual helpful information that they can use. And we're recommending books on the show, and so I think, you know, if you read a couple of the books that we're going to talk about, you would know, I think an average investor or person out there would know more than several investment professionals out in the marketplace. Stock brokers is traditionally they've been called, on how finance works, how the capital markets work. And I think it's well worth taking a couple of hours of your life to build a foundation on how to build and manage your investments.
Well, that's my point exactly. Yeah. I mean, you asked me what the biggest mistake investors make, and they don't understand what they're getting invested in. They don't even understand what the stock market is or the bond market is. So, yeah, just the very basics education. You know, Ken, you brought up the book that we're going to recommend. It might be a good time now to talk a little bit about that. Let's get the investors started out right.
Well, what book, Jack, do you recommend that, you know, is a basic book for investors who want to build a foundation of knowledge? What do you recommend?
Well, I like Rational Investing in Irrational Times by Larry Swedrow. And, you know, he's got 52 of the most common mistakes investors make, and I think it's a great place to get started. It's, I don't know, it's about 250, 300 pages, but it talks about the different investment options, whether it's passive or, you know, picking individual stocks or mutual funds. It talks about the costs of investing. It talks about characteristics, and I know that's been a favorite book of yours.
Yeah, and I really like as he goes through each mistake, what I really respect about Larry is he did a good job providing academic or empirical evidence on each of the points that he makes.
Well, why don't you share a couple of those mistakes?
Well, for example, in the beginning of the book, the first mistake that is listed is, are you overconfident of your skills? And I think this is something we saw especially during the technology bubble, and I was working at Charles Schwab, and one of the branches as a investment representative had a lot of clients coming in, opening accounts, some of which didn't want a whole lot of guidance. And what you found is people who had no investment training at all were running large sums of money, their life savings.
I've got a great example for you. Yeah. I had a prospect come to me. It was probably year 2000. He had $10 million invested into five stocks, and I think they were Cisco and Microsoft and, you know, all of those stocks. And he came to me and expecting a 20% annual return. Well, that was unrealistic expectations. And obviously he didn't join us as a client, but I often wondered what happened to those five stocks. I know that Microsoft alone went from $70 down to 20 or whatever.
Yeah. I think it's really put a lot of people in financial hardship. And the flaw of being overconfident has to do with attributing luck or a very small experience in the market and having success to your skill set. And as in the realm of behavioral finance, which has become a pretty popular field of study in how we make decisions, we find that most people, we don't always make rational decisions. We tend to chalk up the successes we have as skill and the failures that we have as bad luck. And it's something that you really need to understand when you start to know your market history and you start to understand how markets work over a long period of time. You know, what was going on during the technology bubble was a very short period of time, and we know that markets go through contractions, expansions, it goes through excesses. And if you happen to be investing in one of those times, another mistake that's often made is we have the tendency to extrapolate or take the present and extrapolate it out into the future indefinitely. So those are just two of the mistakes out of 52 that Larry does a good job talking about.
Well, you and I are certainly big proponents of, getting professional help.
Right.
You know, advisors, whether it's, CPAs or tax professionals or attorneys or, certainly investment advisors as well. These mistakes that investors make are certainly not limited to, the individuals.
That's
advisors
true.
Can get into the same trap, make the same mistakes, or live under those false assumptions.
That's right.
So picking advisors, the best thing to do again is get back, learn the basics, the fundamentals of investing. What are investing? What you're investing in, and then that will help you qualify the advisors that you may use.
Well, I agree 100%, Jack. I think if you're going to utilize an advisor, it makes sense for you to build a foundation of knowledge that says, hey, here's what I believe in. Mm-hmm. I believe that either one, I can beat the market through superior investment selection and I'm going to hire someone to do that, or I believe the market works pretty well at pricing things and I'm going to go down what we call a passively managed strategy, and I'm going to find an advisor who matches my philosophy. I think it's good for investors to know what are realistic expectations from an advisor. How many times have we met with a prospect who thought that they were hiring an advisor to avoid a down market?
Right.
And that's not what we do. Our job isn't to, and no advisor's job should be, in my opinion, to get you, to promise you that you won't ever experience a decline in your portfolio, because that's why you're hiring the advisor.
And if they do promise you that, you need to run.
Yeah, that's right.
You need to run in the opposite direction. Ken, we probably should connect up with Ethan Brogan with our discussion on the IRAs and Roths.
Great. Well, let's see if we can get Ethan on the line here. Ethan?
Yes.
Hi, this is Ken Smith and Jack Monteith, and we're live on the air here.
Hi, Ken and Jack.
Hi, Ethan. Ethan, we had introduced you earlier as a certified financial planner with a master's in financial planning, and one of the topics that we use you and rely on your expertise in our firm is your knowledge of IRAs and Roths and, when is each appropriate, and so could you tell us a little bit of, is there anything new for the year 2000, let's say 2007, for someone that's you know, preparing their taxes now. And, you know, I know maybe there's still a little window of opportunity to make contributions for the IRAs or the Roth. So,
yeah, one of the biggest things probably just being aware of the amount you can contribute to the Roth or the traditional IRA. For 2007, the limit is $4,000 per person. And if you happen to be over 50, you can also contribute an additional $1,000 for 2007. And for 2008, the limits go up a little bit. If you're under 50, it's $5,000, and if you're over 50, it's $6,000.
Well, can anyone make contributions to those IRAs or Roths?
No, there are certain income limitations and rules surrounding that, so it isn't quite as easy as we probably would like it.
Okay, so what should someone make a contribution to, the Roth or the IRA?
Well, I think in general, if you qualify for a Roth, it's a little more difficult to do so. But if you qualify, it probably is a better vehicle to be saving toward if you qualify for it.
Well, Ethan, this is Ken. Could you explain a little bit about what the difference between a Roth IRA and a traditional IRA is? And also, as advisors, we've gotten questions over the years from clients where they ask a question like, how much return should I expect if I invest in a Roth IRA?
Yeah.
A little confusion on that.
Sure, good question, Ken. First question, the primary difference between the two is that a traditional IRA, the money grows that you put into it grows tax-deferred. That basically means it accumulates over time, but once you take the money out is actually when it's taxed. So during that period of time, it's in the IRA or traditional IRA, it grows tax-deferred. In the Roth account, it also grows, it's basically tax-free. It accumulates tax-deferred, and then when you take money out, it's tax-free, actually, which is a big benefit relative to the traditional IRA.
So you don't get a tax deduction when you make a contribution to a Roth, right?
Exactly right. It's after-tax money going into that account.
Okay, but when you, as it grows and gets larger, hopefully you're making smart decisions, or your advisor is. When you go to withdraw from that account, you're not paying any tax on that.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
Ethan, there's a, you know, it's clients always get confused about, well, maybe one spouse is covered with a 401k plan at work, and let's just assume the other spouse is not.
Right.
Can that, the non-covered spouse, can that spouse make a contribution to the Roth or the IRA?
Yes, that's correct. They actually can. If you have one spouse who's covered by a 401k and another spouse is not, the non-covered spouse can make a contribution, a tax-deductible contribution to a traditional IRA if they in total earn less than $156,000 a year.
So if both spouses combined earn less than $136,000, the non-covered spouse can make a contribution to an IRA?
That's correct. The amount is $156,000, however.
$156,000? Okay. Ethan, another question that we often get is, you know, everybody thinks that the IRAs are locked up until 59 and a half. What about somebody that maybe wants to retire at 55?
That's a great question. Yeah, there are ways to access your IRA, your money's in your IRA account, before age 59 and a half without penalties. Now, there's a lot of rules around that, and I think it's probably beyond the scope of this specific conversation, but you should talk with a professional about those options if you're needing to access money pre-59 and a half. It is possible.
Okay.
Well, that brings up a good question, Ethan. If I want to take money out of my IRA, is it any different between a regular or what we're calling a traditional IRA and a Roth IRA before I'm 59 and a half?
There are some rule differences. There are the different types of accounts. For example, in the Roth IRA, you can make any time you put money in that account post-tax, which is the requirement, you can actually access that money on the money that you contributed initially pre age 59 and a half without a problem. Any earnings, however, would be taxed and then penalized if it's pre 59 and a half.
Ethan, used to be people would get worried about let's say on their death that the IRA then became fully taxable. Can you get us up to speed on generally what the current laws are on that?
Yeah, sure. If it's a spousal beneficiary, in other words, if you die and your spouse gets the money,
right.
That person can treat it as their own. The rules apply as if it's been hers the whole time, his or hers the whole time.
Okay.
If it's a non-spousal beneficiary, like let's say one of your children inherit it, then the rules are a little bit different. And it sort of it will depend whether or not you've been taking out required minimum distributions or not. That determinant will figure in what amount you must take out and over what period of time.
Okay. But, you know, that you are able to spread the distribution of those IRAs out, though.
That's exactly right. And typically what happens, it's over the beneficiary's lifetime.
Okay, good. Now, is there any differences on how a Roth is hired, or Roth or an IRA is handled at the death?
They're very, very similar. If it's spousal, it's a very similar type of rules apply, and if it's non-spousal, then the similar types of rules apply. There are some minor differences, but they're basically similar in that money is generally come out over the beneficiary's lifetime.
Okay, so for the Roth, at the death of the owner of the Roth, does the beneficiary retain the non-taxable element of that Roth?
That's exactly right, and that's one of the big estate tax benefits of having the Roth versus the traditional is that the money coming out of the Roth is not only tax-free for you as the owner, but upon your death, your beneficiaries will also inherit that money on a tax-free basis when they were required to take money out of the account.
That's a very powerful benefit.
Yeah.
You said estate tax, but I think what we're referring to is income tax.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, Ken, you said something earlier I wanted to be sure I hit on. You mentioned, can you buy an IRA?
Yeah, right. And what kind of return should a person get on their IRA?
Exactly. Well, really, you can buy the IRA itself isn't an investment. It's simply an investment vehicle in which you can buy any number of things, stocks or bonds, mutual funds or CDs. So the rate of return is entirely dependent on what you choose to purchase once you have deposited money into your IRA account.
Okay. Ethan, one last question on the IRAs then. Is are there any new changes to the laws for the IRAs or the Roths for 2008 that we should know about?
The biggest thing that I would make sure you're aware of is that the contribution limits are adjusting every year. I mentioned already for 2008.
Okay.
It's $5,000 for people under 50, and if you're over 50, it's $6,000. But also the limits in terms of income limits to qualify for contributing also adjust every single year.
And Ethan, you can make a contribution for 2007 until when's the deadline for that?
It's the tax filing deadline, which is April 15th.
Okay.
Unless you file for an extension.
Okay. And one other quick question. You brought up the term required minimum distribution. Could you briefly explain how those two are different, how that's different among the two different IRAs and what that is?
You bet. That's a great question. That's one of the in my mind, one of the great benefits, along with the tax-free nature of the Roth, is that the required minimum distributions actually don't exist for Roth accounts, meaning that in a traditional account, at age 70 and a half, you're required by the government to start taking money out of the account, the traditional IRA, whether or not you need it or not. They want their tax revenue on that. But in a Roth, it's completely different. There are no age limits. You can keep the money in there forever. You don't ever have to take money out.
Okay. Ethan, I've got one clarification now. So making a contribution to an IRA or Roth, I believe the deadline is the filing date and not the extension date.
Okay.
And we might check on that.
Yeah.
We'll clarify that.
And
we certainly believe that if you have a tax professional, when making a decision as to which IRA to choose, you should consult that professional and or your financial advisor in order to make sure that your personal circumstances are being considered. You know, I think what Ethan's giving us a general overview of these vehicles and reminding us that you know, the deadline's quickly approaching for year 2007 contributions.
Right. Well, Ethan, do you mind if our listeners send you questions through our website or our email address?
No, that'd be fine.
Okay. So if you have any questions to follow up with Ethan, you can contact him at the email address contact@successfulinvestingradio.com or visit the website at www.successfulinvestingradio.com.
Right. You can also go directly to one of our company's website, which is www.directionalfs.com, and Ethan will be posting up information about IRA accounts on that website as well.
And, Ken, we're about wrapping up this morning's show, So listeners, absolutely call us or email if you've got topics you'd like us to cover or questions to answer. We'll answer the questions either on the air or through the email.
Great. Thank you very much, and have a wonderful day.
And good morning. Bye.